You're listening to Inkstead, so my guest this week is Tilly Walden. Tilly's been quite active for many years with a number of different books. I think like your first major book, Spinning, came out, I'm going to say 2018?
2017.
There we go. So right as it was originally...
It came out in 17.
Okay. So, well, 10 years later, and your work has kind of come quite a ways in a lot of different directions. You probably have, I'm going to say, 8 to 10 books now out historically, including the Walking Dead trilogy and all of that. I've been a big fan for a long time, and your work is one of those folks who's like, I immediately will just inhale the comic when I get it.
That's great to hear.
Yeah, it's really fantastic stuff, and it's really just such like, I say this like carefully, but it is to me like really pure cartooning, where it's like you're really in the comic, and it is a comic, and it works as a comic.
I agree so much. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, I'm a formalist deep down. Not all my work reflects that, but this latest one really does.
Yeah, and there is a lot of kind of, I'm really fascinated by a lot of formalistic choices within the storytelling that I really like. And when I look at this book, where I was saying before we started recording, is it feels quite different than your other work, in that you're kind of diving into a particular realistic setting that's not your own.
Yes.
Your other work is either memoir or futuristic. And
all my other work's so much more flexible. There's so much more you can just sort of volley yourself all over.
Yeah, like you can, oh, you know what? I'm gonna just create a weird psychedelic cloud for everything. Yep. Just to
exactly, go. No big deal.
And you, with a book like this, you kind of place a lot of restrictions because it's his. Historical work in a time of restriction too.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. A story very suited by its own format.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I guess we should actually mention what the book is.
Yeah.
go ahead.
No. Yeah. For those listening, Charity and Sylvia is my latest book. It's a, you know, people have been saying historical graphic novel, but that's kind of odd because it's not really a novel. I would call it a historical comic. I mean, I have my own issues with the term graphic novel. I think it's just a fancy way of saying comic, but it's a real story of two women, Charity Bryant and Sylvia Drake, who are the earliest or among the earliest same-sex couples on record in America. And they lived in Vermont for 44 years of what I would call a marriage, though it wasn't legal at the time to marry. And it's a story of their relationship. It's a story of Vermont. It's a story of the 1800s. It's a story of America. It's a story of faith and Christianity. So it's all wrapped up in a very intense comic burrito. And we can talk all about how I made it and everything. But that's the pitch. That's Charity and Sylvia.
Now, you're not originally from Vermont, originally from Texas, right?
Yeah, I'm when you're from, when you move a lot as a kid, you have to pick a place that you're from. So yeah. I picked Texas. I'm also from New Jersey, but Texas, for whatever reason, I don't know. I do, especially when I talk to my son, I have twang in my voice. I'm like, don't you pick that up right now. So I think I'm from Texas, but Vermont has done a good job of adopting me and is now my home.
You're just very careful when you say God bless that person. You're like, oh,
yep. You better look out. And it's so funny. It's like, whenever I think about the South, I'm like, oh God, I don't want to go back. I don't want to be there. But then when I'm there and we're visiting my parents, I'm like, oh God, I feel connected to this place. An odd sensation, and one many queer people I think identify with when it comes to home. Mixed feelings.
And I mean, Vermont is very different in that aspect then.
Totally. Totally. And it's interesting that in this book, which is took place over 200 years ago, this actual history, it was a land and a location that Charity and Sylvia found acceptance And now all this time later, it's a place where I, my wife and I, and my child also found acceptance. So something similar is still going on here.
It's a place of acceptance, but also it's a place of, or maybe it's just a time of hardship.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of hardship.
Yeah. And that's the kind of like your twin thing is we're talking about their relationship and how they're there for each other. It's how they're there for each other through so much.
Exactly. Yeah. The amount of sort of axe throwing at their lives from, I guess you could say, either the Lord or the universe is pretty unbelievable. The fact that they even lived beyond infancy is insane. Both of them are the youngest of eight. Charity's mother died shortly after she was born, and there's no formula in the late 1700s. So the fact that she lived is incredible. Yeah. Sylvia was in a deeply impoverished family. The fact that she didn't starve is incredible. And both of them, their lives were just like a series of tragedies and hardships, illness, plagues, smallpox, consumption, which is tuberculosis. And then just the regular issues of early American life, you know, wars break out, skirmishes, fires, falling off of horses, falling off of wagons, drowning in lakes, drowning in a barrel of cider. That happened to someone near them. It's really when I was doing the research, I was like, this is getting unhinged, the amount of just sort of madness all around them. But that was life.
That's funny. For yourself, tell me about your first kind of moving to Vermont. And were you familiar with the locale, or was it kind of a...
Only a little bit, because when you live in New Jersey, people in my town in New Jersey would occasionally go to Vermont and like ski or just drive past through. And I remember driving through and it being really snowy and kind of empty and a little haunting. That was my only sense of Vermont, was that there's a lot of snow and it's like a little eerie. But I moved there when I was 18. So the day after I graduated high school, I drove up to Vermont.
Oh, wow.
To live there and go to the Center for Cartoon Studies, which is one of the few comic schools in America, and it's where I now teach. And that was my first experience of Vermont, which was driving in, and on the highway sign for White River Junction, it literally says the Center for Cartoon Studies. Like, they put it on the sign. And I fell in love right away. I was like immediately smitten. It wasn't going to be hard coming from Texas. I would have loved anywhere I showed up to, I think, if it had been different. But I was immediately moved by the landscape, by the smallness of the towns, by the changing of the seasons. And it helps that I really loved going to comic school. So it all became this big confluence. But when I graduated from CCS 2 years later, you know, I've lived in Vermont for 2 years and it's become home. Everyone around me was like, you're 20. You cannot stay here. You have to go experience the world. Cause I kind of wanted to just like hunker down and make comics and live in the snow and the foliage. But I listened to the advice, and I then spent the next like 6-7 years like traveling the world and making books. So, you know, I tried to hit up most continents, every major city, and I just lived with a scanner in my suitcase so I could make books and keep them with me. And then around 2019, 2020, I was like, time to come home. I'm in love with a girl in Vermont. It's ready. It's time. Let's go back. I always knew I'd come back. And then I came back, and the rest is history.
I've been to White River Junction. It is very picturesque. You're kind of,
I'll call it a movie set town. It looks like a little movie set.
Yeah, you're nestled in kind of in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah,
it's like a little train station.
Trains, yeah, it is a junction. There's an old steam engine just sitting there. The Amtrak still comes through. It's and I've watched too, back in 2014 when I was first in Vermont. It wasn't like on a ton of people's radar, but the pandemic really changed things. Everyone wanted a second home here, and it's really, Vermont also has a lot of other issues it's going through right now as a very lowly populated state. It's the second least populated state in the country. Looking at you, Wyoming, for number one. So Vermont has a lot of issues, and it was interesting working on this book which in a lot of ways is like a love letter to Vermont and mm-hmm. So much about what I love about this state, but it is also a little bit about what this state is struggling with, which it was struggling with similar things back in the 1800s. People grew up here and then they'd leave because there weren't economic opportunities. They had to go somewhere bigger. But this is a problem with rural areas across the continent.
Well, even with the in the book, I mean, you see people traveling supposedly, you know, at that time, great distances.
Yes.
150 miles.
Yes, you know, to Massachusetts. But in a sleigh, that takes a hot minute.
Yeah. That's got to be a rough ride. How long is it by sleigh?
You know, I tried really hard to figure this out. And obviously, as an artist, I'm very anti-AI. So I refuse to ask AI because I think it could probably figure it out in 2 seconds, but I'm not asking it. It took... Their journey to Massachusetts took like a month, it seems. Yeah. They would stop along the way, and they've done it both styles. They would go by sleigh and horse. They would go by carriage. There were sort of the 1800s equivalent of kind of like bus routes, like these certain carriages would stop at a similar place every so often and pick up people and take them along the way. But they'd have to write to their relatives and say, in 2 months, I might be at your house and need a place to stay for the night. And then their relatives would write back and be like, okay, hopefully see you there. There's no texting the morning of being like, on my way, about to be there. Sometimes they'd show up like a month late because plans would change. So it was wild having to, because they were both from Massachusetts. So they were always going home to visit family.
But ultimately the move to Vermont, was one for opportunity.
It was for
Sylvia's brother and for Charity really getting rid of trying to step away from her own past.
Yes.
And that type of thing. So I'm interested in that, like that place that they find there.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Charity lived in Massachusetts and really eventually it sort of became known that she was gay. And was she subtle with her girlfriends? Not really. I mean, it's sort of her own fault that people found out that she was gay. I'm sorry for her that she couldn't live in a time when it was acceptable, but she had a lot of girlfriends and one of them was the daughter of a minister. So that was a dicey choice, but I'm just going to turn my video off really quick because I feel like it's clamming up.
I'll turn mine off too, just in case.
Okay, just in case. Yes.
Yeah, we're audio. It doesn't matter.
Yeah, we're audio. It's all good. So Charity had to find somewhere to be. Sylvia also, her family was destitute in Massachusetts, like truly the poorest of the poor. There was nothing there for them. And Sylvia's brother basically ran away to Vermont in the middle of the night seeking economic opportunity and did exactly what you're supposed to do when you run away in the middle of the night to a new place, which is to find the mill owner's daughter and marry her. And so he did. And he got kind of wealthy really quick because he and the mill owner's daughter like became smitten. And then Asaph invited his family to join him in Vermont. And what's interesting about Charity and Sylvia is they were sort of new of each other on the periphery. Sylvia's sister was church friends with Charity. And after Sylvia's family moved to Vermont to follow the economic opportunity, they invited Charity to come visit. And this invitation to come visit coincided with the moment when the rumors about Charity were like at a fever pitch.
Yeah.
And so it was perfect. And so Charity went to go stay in Vermont for like a few months and visit her friend, her church friend, Polly. And then Polly's sister, Sylvia, was there looking really cute, being really nice, also kind of gay. And they connected with one another in 1807 and then lived the rest of their lives together. They shared a bed every night for the next 44 years.
And built a home and
built a home together. Yes, very, very odd for the time. I mean, you even with a rudimentary knowledge of history, you can know that women couldn't own land. Women weren't exactly building their own homes. But they worked out a deal with another woman who had sort of through odd circumstance, managed to get her land in her name because of a drunken husband. It's the whole thing. And then they, through the support of their family that they ultimately found, their brothers showed up and built him a house.
Now, before diving too deep into the biography and stuff, yeah, I want to kind of dial back to something you said earlier about the formalism.
Yes.
In your storytelling and some of the particular choices you made. And early on, I was really, really struck by the way you, I forget, it was the, can't find my note, of drawing thoughts versus sensations.
Yeah.
And that really was like early in the book, but it was, I felt it was a way of you being like, this isn't just going to be a bunch of talking heads. Like, this is a book of no. feelings as much as anything else.
Gosh, no. No, I wanted to find a way to make this comic that was both formal and traditional in some senses, with the 12-panel grid, with the sort of cohesive style, with the more realistic drawing. But I also really didn't want the book to be boring. I really wanted people to feel engaged with history. It's such a cliche to be looking for that. Like, I want history to come alive, but I really wanted history to come alive. And I knew that I had to find a way, like you said, to not have a book that is just talking heads, even though there's a lot of talking, and there's a lot of heads. so I needed to lean into my own kind of emotional connection to the historical archive. And I ended up kind of slowly adding in these pages that touch on kind of the unknowable parts of the history, like the sensation of, you know, awaiting seeing someone after a while, like the thoughts that go through your head when you're nervous. And I felt like I could pull it off because I think the comic medium is naturally a little bit fictional. Even when it's nonfiction, you know, we're drawing, we have to create. And I felt like I could hold on to the truth and the history while also being somewhat imaginative. And that was the balance I was seeking. It's like, I really did want it to feel like a serious comic, but I also wanted to use what comics are capable of to really make this feel like these women were alive as we are.
And there's something I think about, because you're telling a story in a way that's, you know, visually, and the language folks are using are very kind of a time where when you're doing these kind of more experimental formalistic pieces, you're also doing like some kind of like, here's a universality that everyone can understand.
Right. Yeah, and actually, I didn't think it was that hard to like seek out what was universal about their story, because I think that like most people's lives are hard. Even when we have modern plumbing, most people's lives are difficult. There's a lot of toil, there's a lot of hardship. And that's like, that's what I was reading about in the archive. And it didn't feel too hard to connect the dots, both within myself and for the reader.
It's something we all share, that mundanity of life.
Yeah, God, yeah, all the chores. Yeah, all the things we have to do every day. I think a lot about how, especially with a little kid, it's like the kitchen will never be clean. I will clean it and it will get dirty again. And I will pick up the toys and they will be spilled again. And it's not about getting everything to a state of finish. It is actually about going through the cycle of sort of cleaning and tending again and again and again.
And it's really beautiful how, I mean, you touch on Sylvia, her life, if she hadn't found her person, was really a life of servitude.
It was.
And it just looked horrific. Like, she's basically taking care of other people's children, even in that first chapter. You could just see the toil and the sweat. And it's just like the lack of agency that she has, and how with Charity, it's not just that companionship, but it's that companionship brings a better life.
It did. I'm glad you picked up on that. I think that's actually crucial. It wasn't just that they were like, you know, two star-crossed lovers who really wanted to spend their lives together. They also found like other answers in their relationship. And for Sylvia, if you're a spinster, if you're a solo woman and you have seven brothers and sisters and they all have seven kids, it is your duty to care for them. It is your duty to care for your mother. It is your duty. And like she would have been washing cloth diapers till the day she died if she had met Charity. And Charity had work because Charity was a tailor. And by teaching Sylvia how to be a tailor, which was how they initially justified their relationship, is they said, like, oh, Sylvia's my apprentice.
Yeah.
It was that, the fact that they had something to do and something to sort of justify themselves to the community with was such a huge key to their success.
Well, and Charity as well made that choice of not living a life of servitude.
But Charity was able to do that because she came from a wealthier family. Charity had more economic ground to start on. She had a brother who was a doctor. She had a dad who was a doctor. She had sisters who married well. So she could have just loitered with her siblings for a long time. And their houses were big enough that it would have been okay. Sylvia couldn't loiter with anyone. She had to work for her place and her meal. You know, it was a really different dynamic. And it's actually surprising that Charity, coming from a more educated, more wealthier background, it's surprising to me that she connected with Sylvia, who was kind of like a poor farm girl. Because to Charity, like, poetry and literature was very important to her, and Sylvia wasn't very well read when they met. But their connection transcended class. And ultimately, Sylvia did end up reading a lot and writing a lot and creating a lot in her lifetime with Charity's influence.
And you can see that, like, faith was, in the beginning, much more important part of Sylvia's life, mm-hmm. where it seemed to creep up on Charity.
It did, yeah.
Become more, and I'm interested in that aspect and the role that faith plays throughout the book, and how you kind of weave in particular biblical verses as part of that narrative.
Yeah, you know, that's actually what part of what drew me to this story to begin with is, I've written a lot of books about lesbians. This is not my first like book about two women who are, oh my God, we like each other. And I wasn't actually drawn to the story just because they happened to survive and be out lesbians in the 1800s. That is interesting, but what really interested me in their story was the fact that they were also deeply pious and very involved in their religious community throughout their lives. And if anything, Christianity, especially to Sylvia, was like more important to them sometimes than their own relationship with each other. I always tell people like they loved each other, but they loved Jesus a little bit more. And I've never written about a book about the intersection of faith and queerness. And I was pumped. I was like, this is really cool. And this was something I really wanted to explore in this story.
Is faith something that's been a part of your life in the past?
You know, only somewhat. I'm not Christian, I'm Jewish, but Judaism is important to me. It was very important, especially to my grandpa, who I was very close to until he died. And of me and my siblings and my cousins, I'm kind of the only one who still, you know, goes to a synagogue, and I hope for my son to go to, you know, things like Hebrew school if he's into it. So it does matter to me, but it's very in the background, and it doesn't feel like something that is particularly au courant. It's not religion gets a really bad rap in queer communities for good reason. Because a lot of people found hate there or were pushed out of their faith communities. But especially as I get older, I find myself craving more spiritual community and more connection. And you know, I don't always want to just like go to a bar with my friends. There is something different about going to Shabbat or services or the High Holy Days and feeling like you are around all these other people who you wouldn't be with, especially for me right now, where I live in Vermont. it's a lot of elderly people who live here. Vermont is kind of an old state. And I've really loved spending more time around people who are not my age. Another thing that I think is cool with queerness is meeting like older gays and older people who've been around doing this longer than you. There's a lot to learn.
I mean, and well, especially in queer communities, the elder queers have been through and seen so much to get to where we are today.
It's so true. When there's an exhibit about Charity and Sylvia at the museum where I was doing all my research. And when the exhibit opened, I drew on the walls and put all their stuff in this room. It's very cool and pretty. But I met the couple, this older lesbian couple, who were the first married couple in Vermont. And, you know, I got married in Vermont in 2021. And it was just so cool to like see the continuum. And what they said to me is they were like, we had no idea we could have had a kid. Like that wasn't something that we knew was possible. And you know, I was at this exhibit with my 2-year-old, just feeling really grateful that I got to be in my current timeline. I got to, you know, until I was 19, gay marriage was illegal, but it did legalize in time when I was ready to get married. And then when it was time that I could have a child, it was possible. Other people had done this. And I think about this with Charity and Sylvia. Obviously, it was very out of the question for them to ever have a kid. But if it had been possible, I think they would have loved it. I think they would have been great moms.
You can see the affection they have for their nieces and nephews.
Yes.
And the role they play in their lives.
But they are lucky in a way that they didn't have kids, because both of their bodies, despite the many ailments they had, persevered longer, you know, than their sisters and friends, who each, you know, bore 7, 8, 9 kids, you know, miscarriages and stillbirths and a whole host of issues. They lived longer lives because they didn't have kids.
Yeah. It's both the physical and emotional toll.
Yeah.
Things. And you get into that a bit with the loss of the one niece and how that affects the mother.
Yes, I do. Yeah. And that's all true. Sadly, there were nieces and nephews that they got especially attached to, Charity and Sylvia, that I found myself getting attached to. And unfortunately, their lives just weren't that long.
Now, in the story itself, like we talk about that formalism and the way to show the emotion, but also the way you kind of break the story up into little vignettes.
Yes.
Little snapshots of time. And I'm interested in, like, when you have this, like, how much information to boil down to what you feel the essentials, and how you come to those essentials. And I'm imagining there's been a lot of revisions to get to you.
Yeah, it's, you know, there were and there weren't. I think that when I decided on the format very early on. I had just started the research. And the director of the museum came by while I was reading these old letters and was like, so what's the comic going to be like? And I was like, it's going to be vignettes. It's going to be one page vignettes. And I hadn't even really thought about it. It just kind of came out of my mouth. And then I was like, why did I say that? And the more I thought about it, I had two sort of big influences. One isn't a story told in vignettes, but is one sort of that largely uses the grid, which is Annie Sullivan by Joseph Lambert, which is
a
historical comic that I adore. Joe Lambert is one of my like foundational influences in cartooning. He's just, his work has had a big, big impact on me.
It's quite unparalleled work.
I had Annie Sullivan next to my Bible the whole time I was working on this book on my desk. So it was always there. So I had been wanting to make a comic on the grid. So that was one part. And then the vignette style, I have always been really influenced by Kate Beaton's diary comics that she put on Twitter many years ago, especially when she was making diary comics about like really intense subject matter, like loss of a sibling. And I was very moved by those comics when she was posting them. And I was I took notice of the fact that they were often titled. And I felt like the vignettes, these like 4-panel comics with the title at the top, I just kept thinking to myself, I have to do that someday. There's something about inviting the reader in with a title. And way before I read Kate's comics, I was a big fan of Azumanga Daioh by Kiyohiko Azuma, which is this silly manga told in 4-panel strips, and each one is titled. And I remember even noticing it as a kid, like, huh, I like that these have titles. And so Azumanga Daioh, then leading to Kate's comics, then reading Annie Sullivan, all kind of mishmashed inside me to come to this form, which was I wanted to do 12 panel grids on every single page without fail. And I wanted every 12 panel grid to be titled. And once I decided that, back to your original question, when it came to coming up with the essential information, really boiling it down, this is why short form comics are hard. This is why vignettes are hard, is you don't have room to meander. It wasn't that hard for me because I had spent over a year just doing research. It was all sitting inside of me. And I discovered once I started drafting the book that this form really suited me. And I started just thinking in vignettes and choosing what was essential became a very efficient process. I just sort of looked at the history and looked at the archive and was like, I know exactly what to say. And as I went through the first draft, I started to get a handle on the voice of this era and how I was going to, in my own way, adapt it and use it. And I kind of flew through it. And the first draft was different from the final book. There were changes, but it is essentially the same book. And while I then drafted it twice more, the changes were not too significant. And a lot of the vignettes are exactly what they were when I drafted it out the first time. So this style made a lot of sense to me.
I also like that you use the titling to kind of inject some humor.
Yes, yes.
When it's, because it's a hard story of hard lives, but yeah, you're like finding ways to like kind of find levity in that moment. Yeah.
You know, it's weirdly one of my funniest books of all of the books I've made, which is, it's just strange to say. It's because it's also a very sad and serious book. But
yeah,
I did find myself injecting a lot of humor in it. And I think it was because I was starting to like lose my mind a little bit with the research, because I was, you know, I had like a newborn baby when I was starting the research. I was like, I was tired and literally out of my mind. And then everything I was reading was just like journals and letters and poetry from these two specific women and their family in this specific part of the country. And I started thinking in the way that they wrote. It totally, totally filled me up. And I think because I was loopy, because I was so tired, a lot of humor started bleeding out of me, because I just wasn't all the, everything that makes me a balanced human was completely unbalanced.
When I think about folks doing, like, especially folks that traditionally have done a fair amount of memoir and then doing historical work, it's where do they find themselves in that historical work? And I feel like that's where the humor and the humor, but also the documenting of these social injustices.
Like I didn't want to ignore the fact that like a Gen Z lesbian was writing this book. I think that I didn't want to pretend that it was like only the history and only the facts, and you can't see me, you can't see my hand. I think comics are very intimate, and especially the fact that not only is obviously the whole book drawn by hand on paper, but every panel border, every word, it's entirely hand lettered. I felt like I needed to let my perspective and my perspective on how history has changed bleed in a little bit. So when speaking about things like, the decimation of indigenous lives, of slavery, of the rights that, were so few for women, and for so many people, that modern voice does occasionally hint in there, and nod and nudge. And the thing that I wanted to acknowledge at a few different junctures in the book was how advanced in a lot of ways Charity and Sylvia's lives were. Like, there was brilliant technology all around them. There were, when it came to like to farming and blacksmiths and building, and the, you know, the homes they lived in weren't just log cabins. They were like complex framed homes. They had cisterns and cellars, and I think I was amazed at what they were capable of in this time. It wasn't nearly as primitive as I think I thought it was. Yeah. And yet it still took over 200 years to get to something like marriage equality. I had to be born and live my whole childhood until marriage equality could even begin to be something that was okay. So I was flabbergasted by that, by the fact that like we basically had a prototype of a flush toilet in the 1800s, and we had zippers, and we had heated carriages, and yet we couldn't let women and men marry each other until 2015.
I mean, the hard part about saying that though is like they're not even necessarily sacrosanct, inalienable rights in a way, because it's still a fight to sustain these rights.
I know. And I've lived more of my life where I haven't been allowed to be married than I have. You know, I have not forgotten. And I think it's there are so many issues on the table right now. There are so many dangers. There's so many threats. It's easy to forget that a lot of this stuff is still really new, the fact that we even had it. And I'm still bitter about it. And I'm never gonna not be bitter about it. Because while every child around me was like, you know, assumed they would be married someday if that was what they wanted, I knew very clearly it was not something I would ever be allowed to do.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's interesting. I mean, we were talking before about with young people exploring their gender and their sexualities. And now we're at a time where it's okay just to figure out, and you don't need to label things immediately.
Yeah, that's a really cool new thing that we have. The big difference, and the thing that I was interested in touching on in this book, is like the way, like right now, when you discover who you are, or even you're just curious about who you are and you're interested in exploring it, is we really individualize. Like everything is very much about the individual right now. It's, we not only do we live very curated lives with curated music and curated feeds and curated objects around us, when we experience some queerness in ourselves, we express it to other people by saying, "This is why I'm different." Yeah. And what's interesting to me about Charity and Sylvia is the way they found acceptance in Vermont in 1807 was by looking at their neighbors and family and saying, "This is why I'm the same
with
you." And they found within themselves a lot of commonality, but in their community, their faith, their beliefs, a lot of their values really aligned with their neighbors. And their gayness, it was a very different style for finding acceptance. They didn't really call attention to it. They instead focused on being very community-minded. And if I'm honest, I do wish we had a little bit more of that now, because I think that while becoming an individual is huge and important, I think that it's also lonely, and community has and is breaking down, especially with the internet changing everything. Yeah. And I was happy to live in their community with them while I made this book. And I'm happy to say that even now in small town Vermont where I live, there is so much community. There were just two tornadoes in Vermont. Don't ask me why that happened. I don't know. And it was crazy what we had to go through to even get home, because there were so many trees and power lines down, and, you know, a neighbor rescued my wife and son and carried them through all these trees and power lines. I came home from a book event at at midnight. I couldn't get down my road. I just started walking in the dark. I don't even have a smartphone. I just have a flip phone, but my flip phone does have a flashlight. So I'm just like wandering in the dark with my little flashlight, wondering if I'm going to get eaten by a bear. And all of a sudden some pickup truck is barreling down the road and a man named Toby is like, "Do you need a ride?" And Toby drove me home. I've never met Toby. And that feeling of supporting each other through any crisis, I feel it very strongly where I live, and I don't live that far from where Charity and Sylvia lived. And I think they felt it too. And I think it's so special that they got to feel it while also being gay, while also being who they are.
It's funny. Yeah. You touch on a thing where, cause I've lived most of my life in Vancouver, where I've spent some time in small towns on the island. And you see that kind of where you have those small rural settings and folks do get much more tight knit, and it can be in a positive way or it can be a negative way.
Yeah, it can be both.
Yeah.
Cause you can be an outcast. And if you don't get along with your community, it can be such a miserable and hard thing for people. And this is why people often have to leave small towns, is because they don't feel connected with it. And I feel grateful that I do feel connected with my town.
And I feel like that's a bit of the case with Charity and Sylvia, is knowing that in order to live there, they can't just live there as doing their own thing. They need to be fully enmeshed in everything.
They do. And luckily, I think for them, it wasn't that hard in that these were not liberal women. They were exceptionally conservative. There is no way they thought women should vote. And while they did smile upon thoughts of abolition, I would not call them activists. And I would not say that their beliefs were actually ones that align with my own. And it's one of another reason I found them as a very compelling case for a graphic novel, is that they were, they're kind of messy. They're like, they are imperfect. What's the word I'm looking for? Not heroes, but like the kind of people you look up to. They're not perfect role models. They were just regular women. And I think that that's so cool to think about. Just like two regular women with complicated beliefs, in spite of it all, continuing to like persevere and be themselves.
And it's hard to place ourselves and place judgments when there's so much we don't understand in our own place.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was a different time, but it is also a constant question in any era. It's like, when you see injustice, will you within yourself find a way to stand up to it or say that what you see is wrong? And it's something that is still hard. And still complicated. And I think a lot of people feel now, well, no, it's easy. You see it and you say what's wrong. But there's just so many different kinds of people out there. It's the breadth of humanity, really. Just, I'm in awe of it constantly. I think it's just sort of unbelievable how we're all tumbling around on this planet with all these different beliefs and ideas of right and wrong, and a good life and a bad life, and somehow we're all stuck doing it next to each other.
Now, we were talking earlier about faith, and one of the things I wanted to get a little bit more of that is kind of how you chose Bible verses to make it through, because you talked about how Joseph's book was, next to you, which I will say is really, folks should check it out. It's profound in a way of being able to tell things about Helen Keller's life with visuals that's unparalleled. But
yeah, any Sullivan ever made, but that's a whole other thing.
But you also mentioned that the Bible was right there, and so that choice, and growing up Jewish, I don't think the New Testament was necessarily a big part of your.
It was not. No, it was not. I had to learn about this man named Jesus. I thought it was super interesting, and how I picked Bible verses was a combination of Sylvia was very particular in her journal about when she went to church. She was a Congregationalist. She wrote out the scripture almost every time. Whatever the Reverend said, she wrote down. So some of the verses came directly from her journal because I knew they were what she had heard. But the rest, and especially some that were used towards the end of their lives in the final pages of the book, I stumbled upon very naturally just by sitting there reading the Bible at my desk and waiting to be inspired. And I would flip through and I'd read and I'd be like, God, this is boring. And then other times I'd be like, whoa, this is interesting. This is wild stuff. And I really just sat and read it and waited to be moved or waited to find words or passages that felt like they matched what was happening in the comic at the time. Yeah. I will say copy editing Bible verses from the 1840s, not fun to do. Didn't like it. It was really annoying to like, cause there were many reasons why it was tough, but a lot of my copy editing had to do with the Bible verses and ensuring everything was exactly as it should be. And that was a pill.
Love it. And the other piece you weave in is poetry.
Yeah, and a lot of poetry.
Using poetry to create space and kind of everything. Meditate. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, Charity was a poet. I wish I could say she was like an amazing poet. I think that she was actually somewhat restricted in her poetry by her conservative beliefs, because I think she felt often unable to write beyond the confines of her existence. Like someone like Emily Dickinson was so unhinged and able to like see and believe anything that her poetry was incredible. And Emily, their lives overlapped a little bit. And there's actually some evidence that Emily may have known that Charity and Sylvia existed as a gay couple, which is very cool. And very fun to think about. But Charity's poetry was like a little stiff and a little stodgy. She was usually writing poetry about telling her nephews to like love the Lord and do your homework and be quiet and be tidy and be nice. Every now and then she touched on the darker and more beautiful things in her life. And I tried to use that poetry anytime I could in the book. But I was influenced by a lot of the poetry at this time, and I was influenced by the poetry of Charity's nephew. Charity's nephew became quite a well-known poet, William Cullen Bryant, and I carried around a little pamphlet of his poems with me, another talisman, while I worked on the book. So every time I was stuck in a line or at the dentist, I would just sit there and read William's poetry, and that was another influence on the book.
How did William's poetry kind of, did it influence at all within your own writing style and the way you kind of told that latter days of their life?
I think it did. It's always hard to keep track of influences because they're always sort of floating around you and
they're part of the soup.
Yeah, they're part of the soup. And what's weird about influences is sometimes they come out a few years late. You know, it's like you read something a few years ago and then all of a sudden you feel it appearing in your work. But I would say, yeah, I do think his very sort of theological and nature-based and evocative word choice came into play. He also just more tangibly influenced the later part of the story because he wrote and published a short piece about Charity and Sylvia, which is a cherry on top of the pile of evidence we have about their lives and the proof that they really were a gay couple. But that comes into play later in the book, what he wrote and published about them.
It's very cheeky.
I know. I'm really, yeah, he refers to Charity, or we assume
the charity work.
As the man of the house, as the husband, which I think is hilarious.
Yeah. We talked about Vermont being your home. And I'm interested in getting to know them, getting to know their story. Is also like, did you take time to explore the community they lived in and the roads they traveled?
Yes.
And understanding that geography.
Totally. Yeah. I walked and drove the roads all around Weybridge, the town they lived in, which is right next to Middlebury, Vermont, which a lot of people have heard of. I explored the communities. I was able to go into the church that still stands, wow, that they went to in the 1840s, 1850s, and now has a queer minister, which is very cool. I spent a lot of time all over the state, not only, you know, talking about the book when it was in progress, but yeah, trying to notice what could have been there. Unfortunately, you know, Vermont looked really different in their time. A lot of it was clear cut because of sheep. Sheep were a thing. And they cut down a lot of the trees, and a lot of the trees have now come back. So I did have to sort of force myself to try to imagine, like, okay, there's like 200 trees right in front of me. Just imagine they're gone. Imagine they're gone, and imagine a small house and a well. What would that look like? But yeah, a lot of traversing the state and a lot of traversing cemeteries and graveyards to find Charity and Sylvia. They weren't hard to find. They're buried together, but they're relatives. And I did have to go to Massachusetts to find some of their relatives. And that was fun too.
Did you do any like backroads driving between Vermont and Massachusetts just to get
it was only backroads driving. It's all dirt roads. It's all getting lost. Luckily I live on a dirt road, so I have no fear. Me and my pickup truck can handle anything.
Love it. My one time going to Vermont, we went through Massachusetts and we got pulled over because the cop thought we were drug mules. And the minute they opened the window to see me and Jen Vaughn as the folks, they went, "Oh, you are far too dirty to be drug mules."
That is beautiful.
I love that experience so much. Jen with like this bright pink hair and, you know, me being very nerdy, and they're like, "Oh, nope, never mind." Just immediate thing. I don't know why.
This happened to me in Texas. I was like, you know, all messy and had sunglasses on and looked very artsy. But in Texas, that looks threatening. So they pulled me over and they thought I was a drug mule. And they were like, "Why is all your stuff covered up in the back with blankets?" And I was like, "My crayons are in there and they're going to melt because the Texas sun is so hot." And they were like, "That's not true." And then I pulled the blanket back and it was a bunch of crayons. And I was like, "Did I tell you? My crayons keep melting. I had to cover them up."
Oh my God, I love that. Developing the book, vignettes, points in time, but you do make an aggressive time jump.
I do.
Significant time jump. And with that, I'm interested in like how you see these points in their lives as really those key storytelling pieces. Those are the parts that need to be shared and explored.
I was relying on the parts of their lives when I had the most information.
Okay.
So that is part of what influenced it. I was able to get a grasp on largely everything in their lives, but there were eras that were very clear, and their young adulthood, their old age, and their childhood. It starts with their young adulthood, it jumps to their childhood, and then it kind of jumps to their elderly years. But I actually, that layout of time makes a lot of sense to me, because I think that in your youth, in your discovering who you are as an adult, you're kind of pushing childhood away because you're trying to be who you are now. But then going into what my mother would call your sunset years, I think you reflect. And I think thinking about where you began is very connected to how things end. And so that layout made a lot of sense to me, but I was like lost in this historical record at a lot of junctures where I was just like, 1820 is 1840 and I don't know where 1810 is and I'm, how old is everyone? I was constantly reassessing to be like, wait a second, it's 1831. I forgot how old Charity is. How old Sylvia? And then I kept having to figure out how much their nieces and nephews had aged to make sure they were getting bigger. Because there's a huge cast in this book. There's so many people. And I did not include a lot of people who probably would be very mad at me for not including them.
Some big egos.
Yeah, but it was pages were too busy. It's too hard on a 12 panel grid. So many tiny crowd scenes in this book.
Yeah. You have a lot of like really intimate dinner conversations.
A lot of dinners. Well, they were always, Sylvia was always writing in her journal like, well, 23 people came over for dinner. And I'm like, that's crazy. I have 3 people over for dinner and I'm stressed. I'm like, I gotta fill up the water carafe. I gotta get the napkins. I gotta vacuum. I gotta put the trucks away, put the Legos away. I don't know how they did it. The thing I really would love to ask them if they were alive now, there's a lot I'd want to ask them, but how did they deal with having enough seats and having enough chairs? Like, did they borrow chairs from their neighbors? Did people just stand? Like, what do you do?
Do you bring your own chair to
bring your own chair? I don't know.
Part of me would love that idea if like I went to someone's house for dinner and I brought my own chair if I didn't like their chairs.
I know. Actually, like I like my chair more than most other chairs. So I think we'd all be more comfortable.
It's not too bad. I mean, there's some good ideas there.
Yeah.
Your ending to the work was incredibly powerful. I was a little like, you got me a lot of feels out of this.
Yeah.
And that's not easy to do.
I was working towards it for the whole book. I always tell my students that, you know, what comics are really good at is lulling a reader into a sense of this is how the story is told. And I convince you that this is how the story is told page by page, vignette by vignette. And I don't want to spoil it for anyone who hasn't read it. Even though you can probably conclude what event ends the book. But I was chomping at the bit to like elaborate on the form I had established to bring about an emotional ending. And I knew the whole book, what I was going to do with it. And I could see it and I could like taste it. But it was, you know, so many months of work for me to get to that revelation and that conclusion. And I had a sense of what the wording would be. I had a sense of what the idea would be, but I was kind of rewriting it as I got to it because I needed the words to be perfect and stay.
Well, that's where you kind of really shine that formalism and you really allow, and I'm fascinated about that. So you worked on the story, like in terms of that final draft, pretty chronologically, like in terms of page by page. I'm doing page 20 today, page 21 tomorrow.
Exactly. Yes.
Interesting.
Yeah, it was very, it was extremely chronological. And then I went and did all the panel borders for the whole book, which took 2 months. And then I did all the lettering, which took a month. And then I went back and did all the art.
Okay.
But I didn't do the lettering on the final sequence. I left it blank. Because until I went back for the art, because I couldn't grasp what it was totally yet until I had done the art. And then that final sequence, I had the panel borders done, but then I put in the text and words in one go.
Working on this book, how closely did you work with any kind of editors at D&Q and that kind of support, or did a lot sit in your head?
A lot of it was in my head. I mean, I don't want to, you know, Tracy did help a lot at Drawn and Quarterly, especially with getting the draft to its final state. I remember one of her notes was more kissing. and it was a great note. I didn't originally include the April Fool's joke, which was a real thing in the historical record. And Tracy encouraged me to include that. So there was a lot of editing on the draft, not only from D&Q, but from historians, from people who work at the museum, from people at Vermont Humanities, like, so actually way more organizational feedback than I'm used to. And I was getting a little antsy where I was like, okay, I get it. They didn't have umbrellas. Like, give me the rest of the notes so I can draw this book. But then when I drew the final art, that was when I did my editing. That was when I made it what it was. And I think I surprised Tracy a little bit because the book changed in these sort of subtle ways as I did the final art. But that's always been what I do with my comics. Yeah. I always edit and change while I'm drawing the final art. I move characters, I change dialogue, I fiddle with things, I finesse. And I like to do that in a vacuum. I like to do that alone. I don't want anyone to see me doing it. I want to feel like it's just me and the comic. And then I just sort of emerge a few months later and hope people like it. Luckily, Tracy liked it.
And I think that kind of brings back to the beginning when we're talking about the difference of doing a nonfiction work, comic like this, and the obligations you have, but you still need to find your voice in it and the story you want to tell.
Yeah. So true.
And you talk about not being an historian.
No.
And approaching this without that lens.
Yeah. Which I felt like was a weakness. And I think I managed to like transmute it into a strength because I realized along the way that I didn't need, I mean, I'm going to make some historians mad, but I didn't feel like I ultimately needed special skills in reading this archive. I just needed to give the archive my full attention and really come to know their history as best I could. And from there, I felt I could do their story justice.
I mean, I'll say I have a history degree as someone who's, you know, and I do my own work about writing about comic history and stuff.
Yeah. And
it's really, you got to be careful about how far you get lost in the weeds.
Yeah.
That's something where I think you really have that strength of, as a storyteller, knowing what's important. What are these key pieces versus like,
oh, it's so true.
I know Jacques Tardy would get lost on, you know, having accuracy for every little piece of military machinery. And that's great. But how much will that translate to the reader?
Right. Right. And this is, I don't really know exactly how I ultimately made those calls, because I think that I really liked them and I really liked the history. I found it fascinating. And I think because I found it fascinating, I kept being like, oh, this one, oh, this story, oh, this person, this bit. It was whatever compelled me felt like it needed to be in the book. And also I didn't have that much time to do it. And so I suppose that brutality meant that, you know, I didn't get lost in the weeds because there was no time to be lost totally.
After exploring these women's lives so deeply, and diving into historical, is this something you'd want to revisit, or do you want to kind of get back to the imaginary world and your own world?
I want both. I want it all. I would love to do more historical work, and I don't want to be done, especially at the museum that I worked in. I became so close with everyone. I realized I love working in archives. I find it really, really fulfilling to engage with real history like that. So yeah, I'd love to do more historical stuff. And I have like, you know, a bunch of other imaginative worlds just kind of sitting in me, biding their time. I think it's all on the table, nothing for right now. I'm not working on anything, and I don't plan on working on anything probably for the rest of the year. Just going to watch my kid and clean my house and then come back to comics. Yeah.
Now, the other thing I wanted to ask about and kind of have you expand on is just how important, because this is kind of a theme throughout your work, is friendship is important. And how, and I mean, you've chatted before about being in community and stuff, but I'm like, really that personal friendship piece and how you keep visiting that kind of following through in people's lives, because it's your work is never really about kind of covering anyone in particular. It is.
Yeah, I love friendship. I think it's like it's what makes comics about relationships interesting, is it's not just about your one personal love, but it's how you and that love mingle and interact with the whole world around you. And I guess I've talked about friendship in a lot of my books. Are You Listening and On a Sunbeam are both, even Walking Dead is kind of about friendship. Oh, Jesus, they're all about friendship. And it's funny, if you ask me what themes in my work I keep coming back to, I don't actually know if I would say friendship, but I think that's accurate. I think I actually do keep talking about friendship. But I'm always fixated on, now I keep drawing people building houses. That's something I keep doing. Every friggin' book, someone builds a house, even this one, and they
Oh
did
my
actually
God.
build a house.
Love it. Love it. Well, thank you so much, Tilly. I really appreciate you taking the time to chat with me today.
Thank
And
you, Ryan.
yeah, like I said, like your books are some of those that I like immediately will read and love. And this one continues that. So thank you so much.
So happy to talk about it. Thank you.